Welcome to the Kate Languages podcast. I'm your host, Kate Clifton. I'm a former MFL teacher who left the classroom in 2017 to set off on my own adventure. Since then, I've developed my passion for helping teachers through creating time-saving teaching resources, delivering language lessons and CPD to languages teachers, and of course, through this podcast. I've had some wonderful feedback from teachers about how my work is helping them with their everyday teaching, and I love connecting with teachers from all over the world. To get in touch, you can find me on Instagram and Facebook. I'm at Kate Languages on both. Or you can email me through my website, katelanguages.co.uk. But for now, grab a cuppa, although maybe not if you're listening in the car. Sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode of the Kate Languages podcast. Hi, welcome to another episode of the Kate Languages podcast. This is the last episode of season 7, which I can't believe it's gone by so fast. And this is my fourth live podcast recording. So I'm here with Claire Wilson this evening, and lots of people have joined us to learn all about how to run a successful school trip. So hi, Claire, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. Good. Thank you. So you've got quite a lot of experience running trips, right?
I have. Yes. Well, I had, certainly up until about 7 years ago when I had my children, and then I took a hiatus for a few years and then ran one last year and kind of panicked that I'd forgotten everything. And a lot had changed over time. So obviously Brexit and COVID and everything's gone cashless now as well. So yeah, it was almost like starting again. Luckily, a lot of it came back to me sort of in the general day-to-day sort of planning and running of the whole thing, but also a lot was very different. So so I do have a lot of experience, but I would say I've also kind of had to relearn quite a lot of stuff for my most previous trip.
Yeah, that is really good, actually. That is really, really interesting to think about because, yeah, obviously since Brexit and COVID, things have changed enormously. But before we get into the kind of the details of running a trip, for people who don't know you, can you just introduce yourself a little bit and tell people a bit about your background and stuff?
I can. Well, hello, I'm Claire Wilson. I am a languages teacher, obviously. I'm a Germanist by heart. That's my absolute passion. I do currently teach French as well, and I can teach Spanish, although we don't offer Spanish currently at my school. I've been a subject leader for about 12 years. And this year I've been doing more whole school stuff, sort of moved slightly away from MFL, doing more sort of whole school CPD and ITT coordinator stuff, and still a little bit of MFL. I do a lot of the training for the MFL skit students across the trust. So yeah, going in a slightly different direction, but really, really enjoying it. And then obviously I do all the kind of Instagram stuff and a little bit of consulting here and there, which is sort of another side thing that I enjoy as well.
Yeah, busy. So busy. And you have also run a school trip. Right. So when we're thinking about school trips, I mean, literally from the beginning, where do you start? So how do you decide where to take a trip to? Let's literally start right from the start. Yeah. How do you make that decision of like where to go?
Well, do you know what I decided to do today after we'd sort of been chatting on email about the sorts of things that maybe we would want to talk about? I thought I'm going to sit down and write kind of a step by step from start to finish of how to run a trip. And honestly, if you could see some people can see it, I've got pages and pages, and I thought this is going to be more of a monologue than anything else. But yeah, where do you start? I think the starting of it actually is probably the hardest bit, actually getting the trip up and running. Yeah, where to go? I think you have to think about which students you want to aim the trip at. I've done joint language trips. I've done a trip to Germany and France, which we called the Europa trip a few years ago, which was...
Oh, that's a good idea.
It was absolutely brilliant, you know, run between...
Where was that then?
So we went to the Alsace region, so Strasbourg, Freiburg in Germany, so Black Forest. And it was so fun because we were hopping over, you know, the different countries and sort of telling all the kids, oh, now we're in Germany, now we're in France. And yeah, it was really, really exciting. And we had fantastic bright blue hoodies with the EU stars around. Obviously, this was pre-Brexit and Brexit wasn't even a consideration at the time. So yeah, so that was great. So we did that trip. So, you know, thinking obviously which language, you know, you're going to be concentrating on. But I think probably most importantly, which year groups are you going to target? And I think this is quite important because you've got to think about your numbers and whether you're going to get the numbers. I decided last year, so it had been a few years since we'd run a trip. It was way before COVID, before I'd even started at the school, that there had been a languages trip. So I expected it to be popular, but also, you know, the landscape had changed a lot since then, you know, in lots of different ways. And I wasn't sure how much parents would be able to afford, whether there would be the interest there. So I did target year eight right up to sixth form. So it was Germany. It was a trip to Germany, went to the Christmas markets. And I knew that I needed to think about activities that would sort of benefit and attract all different year groups. And I think that's really something to consider. I recently went to Berlin with some friends and, you know, and I was thinking, oh, you know, I'd love to do a trip to Berlin. I haven't ever done one. My concern there would be, would there be enough for younger students? Would they be mature enough to deal with a lot of the history, you know, the Holocaust Museum, even the DDR Museum? We went to the DDR Museum and there were some things in there that I probably wouldn't be allowed to show younger students. So I think, first of all, think about that. Think about the activities that there would be available. That's probably my biggest tip, really, when it comes to deciding where to go.
Yeah. Okay. And the other consideration, I suppose, when you're thinking about where to go is how you're going to get there. So have you flown and taken bus trips, I think?
Yeah. So I've done both. Yeah. So earlier when I first did trips, so when I went on trips as not group leader, we flew. So the first few trips I did were actually to Spain. We always flew, obviously. We're in the Midlands, so Midlands to Spain isn't something you really want to be doing on a bus. I mean, I know that people do it, but we flew. We've done a couple of times where we have flown to Germany, but the last couple that I've done, we have done on the bus, and the main reason has been cost. If we could fly, that would always be my preference, because obviously you can fit so much in, can't you, when you get there, but it does change the cost quite considerably if you fly as opposed to going by bus. So again, to keep costs down, that was my choice this time.
That is so interesting, because we did have a question from somebody who's based in Scotland who said they have to fly abroad. They're in Inverness. And that was Elodie who sent a question before the podcast recording. And she was wondering about the do's and don'ts when you're flying as well. As you said, a bus is not an option for them. So yeah, that makes sense.
No, it isn't. Sorry, I have got notes. I don't normally have notes when I do webinars and things, but I feel like with this one, there's so much detail. Yeah. You know, I can't just go off on a tangent about things that I'm passionate about. It's like, you know, do it this way. So yeah, I did make a few notes. But I think generally when it comes to travel, you know, it doesn't really matter whether you're going by bus or you're going by plane. It's the same principles really involved. You know, it's making sure that obviously that you risk assess properly, and that might be something that we'll talk about at some point. So, you know, making your expectations to the students very clear, ensuring that you're registering at different points. There's lots of things to consider here in terms of remote supervision, but I don't think there's a lot of difference whether you're in an airport or you're in a motorway service station. You know, it's just reminding those students of your expectations and obviously preempting all of that beforehand in your risk assessments. And of course, making sure your staff know where they are, where they need to sit, if it's on the plane, on the bus, their role within that as well.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I suppose on a plane as well, obviously you're not going to have the whole plane to yourselves, are you? So
it feels like you have, when you've got 30 kids on a plane, it feels like you've got the plane to yourself. Honestly, those poor people.
And I was
going to
say, the other passengers
on their
are like, oh no, how have I ended up on a... Can you imagine, like, Ryanair flights are bad enough. Can you imagine being stuck on a Ryanair flight with like 50 kids?
I know. I think flying to Malaga in July, as we used to.
Gosh. So obviously risk assessments are so, so, so important. And I see lots of questions about risk assessments on the Facebook groups and things like that. So, I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, my experience of doing risk assessments. I feel like a lot of schools have them already, or you can adapt them for other stuff. So like, I don't know, if you're going to Disneyland Paris, you can adapt an Alton Towers risk assessment or not. I don't know. Is that...
Absolutely. I see a lot of questions like that on the Facebook groups as well. And I don't know whether those questions have come maybe from people who it's the first time running a trip, or they're not always through the process and know how it works. Because actually... Obviously, one thing I do want to make clear is obviously that all schools or local authorities or trusts, they're all going to have their different policies. So, you know, I can only speak from my own experience and the way that I did it and the way that I was advised to do it. But a lot of local authorities will use something called Evolve, which is their platform really for approving school trips. And on there, you have goodness knows, like, you know, so many risk assessments. They're called generic risk assessments. Now, I'm a bit of a geek and I'm a bit sad and I love the risk assessment part. I mean, I say that. I wasn't saying this if you'd have spoken to me sort of November time when I was finalising them. And I'm sure I spoke to you, Kate, and was feeling quite stressed at this point. But I quite enjoy that process because it makes me think really carefully about the trip. And I know I've had sort of a local authority comment on how good my risk assessments were, just to pop that one in there.
I love it.
I am quite sad with these. I do quite enjoy doing them. So you've got the generic ones, which you would obviously want to adapt to your own scenario. But I don't think, I mean, I do lose sleep over them. I shouldn't do, but you don't need to lose sleep. They are fairly standard. Like you say, you know, a theme park one for England is going to be the same as a theme park in Germany. The ones that I would just pay attention to, it's, I don't know if everybody always realises, in terms of if you've got students with complex medical needs, SEND, also safeguarding.
I was just thinking.
So you're going to have some individual risk assessments. And again, this is where you need to speak to your EVC, so your external visit coordinator in school. So it's worth making sure you know who that person is. Obviously, what I should just say as well is when you're starting a trip, obviously you need to have a chat with your head teacher, and a lot of this needs to be discussed with them. I'm sure that's very obvious, but that's the first port of call.
Usually would a member of SLT be kind of designated as the person who's responsible for trips?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure about this. In our school, we certainly have a member of SLT who oversees it all, but the actual EVC coordinator who would do all of the approving sort of on Evolve was actually also our finance officer. So it was actually a member of support staff.
Quite useful as well.
But I'd still believe it goes through to the member of SLT who also sort of does the final. But also there were things that were going, it still has to go to the head as well. And he still has, obviously, you know, or she, obviously he in our school has ultimate, you know, yes or no. So please do make sure that when you're in those early stages of planning a trip and you've thought about where you want to go and you've thought about, you know, when and how many staff and all that kind of thing. Because there's so many things to consider there as well in terms of when do you go. Again, probably another thing to chat about, but please make sure that you've had all of it discussed and approved with your head teacher and that you've had some advice from your EVC. But yeah, in terms of individual risk assessments. So with the medical forms, these can be very sporadic. You know, I've had medical forms that have come in a week before we've left. I've had medical forms that have been changed literally the day before we've left. So I would advise that you speak to, you know, your pastoral team and get the most up-to-date medical details according to, you know, the school systems, so that you can just start to preempt, you know, anything major. So, you know, I would say on every trip, I've taken somebody that's perhaps needed a little additional care in terms of maybe medication or risk assessment and things that I needed to be aware of. And I just want to have plenty of time to make sure that I know about, you know, those students and that I can speak to the parents. As I said, you know, I will individually risk assess them and I will make sure that the parents are involved, that, you know, pastoral leaders are involved, SENCO if necessary. And also I would chat to your safeguarding team and show them the list of students who you're taking and just get them to just let you know if there's anything you need to be aware of. And I don't know if people always realise the safeguarding side of it. You would always be advised, obviously, for SEND students or any students with medical needs that you've, you know, you've obviously ensured that you can do, you've done everything you can to support those students. But I know our safeguarding lead said, oh, I've never had anybody come and chat to me when you've been going on a trip before. And I just thought, but surely there still might be some things that I need to be aware of. And
yeah,
as it happened, so, you know, nothing major, but there was a couple of things that I did want as the responsible teacher, as the group leader on that trip. There were certain things that I wanted to be made aware of and to know how to deal with if anything were to happen. So,
and in terms of, you know, I'm just thinking like allergies or specific needs, I don't know if a child has epilepsy or something like that, would you advise people to make a little, I don't know, it's like a little card or a little document that they can carry on them in the language? So, you know, if you're going to France, that you have in French, I am allergic to nuts or something. Like, I mean, is that something that is really useful to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Anything like that that you can do to support students, because you're not going to be with them 24/7. You will give them some, you know, generally quite short periods of time where they are in small groups under remote supervision, and anything where you can support them with a little card like that would definitely help. I think, I mean, when it comes to allergies, I mean, this is coming from an allergy mum as well, as you know. So my daughter has lots of serious allergies and is an EpiPen carrier. I have, previous to having my daughter, taken a child with quite serious allergies. And unfortunately, we did have an incident while we were abroad with her. She was fine, but she did need Pyroton. We didn't get as far as needing EpiPen. But I think when you're doing your risk assessment with a situation like that, you're going to have to think about those remote supervision situations. I don't think it's necessarily, in my experience in Europe, just enough to say, well, it's all right, here's a card, you can show them this at the Christmas market and everything will be fine. You know, I would, in that situation, knowing me, and I don't think I'm OTT, even though, again, this is quite personal to me, but anything like that, I would say to that student, if you do want to order something, you need to come and see me first, and then I will speak to that person. We'll decide whether, you know, that's something that we would want to do. Knowing me, I would possibly actually say no to ordering food in those situations, because I just, again, in my own experience, having had a couple of mistakes on a trip and also with my own daughter, that's one where I would probably do all that I can to obviously include that child. But obviously, you've got to manage that risk and think about what you and also the parents of the child, what they're comfortable with and happy with.
Yeah, I mean, just in my own experience with my son over the past couple of years of taking him abroad, I feel like it's getting better. And I feel like things are labelled more. But yeah, you know, on menus and stuff like that, and they could be a bit vague. And I mean, you know, we're lucky in that my son's, he's got a dairy allergy, but it's not severe. So if he had it, he might have a bit of tummy ache. It tends to be a bit of a cumulative thing. So he'd be fine. But no, yeah. And it is a major concern for a lot of people. So that's really good. Right. Let's go back again to kind of thinking about, you know, initial planning and stuff like that. So other questions that I've seen and questions that we've had, would you use a company or would you plan it yourself?
So yes, I've done both. In the early days when I first ran my own trips with my first school, we used travel companies. And then for some reason, I decided when I started running them myself that I could do it all by myself. It was a different school. It was generally the way it was done as well. So yeah, it was all booked on my credit card. Obviously, I was reimbursed, but I planned absolutely from, you know, from beginning to end completely on my own. And obviously a massive advantage of that is the price. You can really, really keep the costs down if you do that. Now, I don't know whether schools allow this. I think some do. I have seen on some Facebook groups where some have said that there are ways of doing this. Again, currently where I am now, I wouldn't do that ever again. I did have a situation in, I think it was my very first one that I was group leader of. We were going to Cologne. I'd booked flights with BMI Baby, 25 students,
I remember them.
All booked,
yeah,
on my own. Yeah. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, they went bust 4 weeks before we were due to fly. So I had 25 flights booked on my credit card and obviously accommodation, everything. We were all ready to go. 4 weeks before they went bust, I saw it on the news. I think it was Easter holidays. So it was slightly earlier than that. It was Easter holidays. Woke up to the news that BMI Baby were no more.
Oh, my gosh.
Panic, panic, panic. I've got 25 kids. I need to get to Germany. Can I ask them for more money? How on earth are we going to get them to Germany? Luckily, I had a very level-headed colleague who I phoned up, who was took the panic, you know, off me. And she's like, right, okay, I'll have a look, see what we can find. And we did manage to find some Ryanair flights for, I think it was an extra £50 per student. So it's something to think about when you're thinking of your costs, is having that contingency. I do allow, I say, quite a decent contingency. So I do add quite a bit more on per child, but obviously you've got to keep it within what you think is reasonable for the trip that you're organizing. So yeah, so long story short, that was fine. And it sorted itself out. It was not a problem. And the two or three trips that I did do sorting it out myself, I mean, they were great. I had complete control over them. I knew that everything was booked. I had phone numbers of, you know, the bus drivers in Germany, of the museums that we were going to. I mean, nowadays, this is a lot easier to get hold of anyway. But at the time, I was in complete control and everything did work really, really well. My experience with travel companies in the past has been that sometimes, obviously, you do pay more money. Obviously, you've got the middleman there, but there's obviously advantages and disadvantages there. There have been occasions where buses haven't turned up. We've been stranded at Madrid airport, you know, once we've arrived and the bus hasn't arrived to take us to the accommodation. We had a boat trip not booked when we were in Strasbourg. So yeah, there is that side of, you lose control slightly, I think, when you use a travel company. You're kind of passing that responsibility onto somebody else who's sat in an office somewhere who's booking it all for you, and you don't always quite know what's been arranged. But actually, I have to say, the recent trip that I did to Germany was absolutely perfect. Not a single problem at all. I didn't need to contact them while I was there. So, you know, it'd be interesting if there was something, how they would have dealt with that. But I can't fault it. So I would do that. I would always, personally now, just for that comfort and reassurance of knowing that I've got that backup, I would use a company. I think it depends on the amount of students you take in as well. If you're doing a small exchange or a small A-level trip, you're going to struggle probably to find a travel company who can keep the costs down enough to do that for you. But I took 48 students. So really, that's an insane amount of money for me to be booking on a credit card that I probably can't even get for that.
In terms of insurance and stuff like that, I'm assuming that, you know, with a company, then they will sort out all of the insurance and all that kind of stuff as well. So that's another thing you don't have to worry about yourself.
No. So you get the school insurance, and we had that anyway. So hopefully it would have covered the flights. Again, I'm not too sure, you know, because there was so much of it I was doing myself. The school insurance was like the travel insurance when we were there. I don't know whether it would have covered us beforehand. Probably in my naivety and my sort of not having a lot of experience at the time, probably should have checked all that. But certainly, yeah, if you use a travel company, you've got the school insurance, but you've also got their own insurance as well. So you kind of got that extra level of reassurance there and security if anything were to go wrong.
And yeah, so in terms of costs and getting the students to pay for the trip as well, do you tend to take instalments, you know, a deposit and then a certain number of instalments? How far in advance do you start getting students to pay for it?
This is an interesting one. I would always try and say, and other people might disagree with me, but I think for my own sort of sanity, really, I would usually give myself 8 or 9 months to think about a trip, you know, from start to finish. Even I think my colleague, as soon as we came back from our trip, was pretty much ready to book the trip for the same weekend the following year. So, you know, give yourself as much time as you can, definitely, to get everything sorted. I think probably most schools now will use parent pay, which, okay, oh, it's so good these days. This is what's so different from when Alice did it, because it's all done by finance. It's all, I think there are options for instalments. So I think we offered 4 instalments for parents. I think our own payments to the travel company were probably fewer than that. But I think the parents had 4 instalments, but obviously they could pay in full if they wanted to as well. And yeah, it's just so different. I mean, when I used to run them before, I'd have kids running up to me with cash and checks, and I'd like go running up to the bursary with all this cash and ticking it off on my own list. And again, that just added that extra level of stress. And, you know, to a certain extent, there's been things that I've done this time, I think maybe where there has been maybe more paperwork, but then in terms of finance and sorting that side of it, it's just all been taken off my hands and it's just been brilliant. So yeah, so at your school, I'm pretty sure we'll have the cashless system. Finance will sort all of that out for you, you know, in conversation with you, in discussion with you. And, you know, we usually sort of sort it out together, but she then followed that up if there were any missing payments. I'd make a couple of phone calls if it was going on quite a while and I thought it probably sounded better coming from me, you know, but we didn't really have too many problems there. That worked well.
So can I ask your most recent trip to Germany, how much did that cost and how many days was it?
I'm trying to remember. Right, let me think. Good question. It was 3 nights and it was about £475.
And does that include all of their food and stuff as well?
Yeah. So that was full board. That was obviously all the travel. And the only things they needed in addition was money for food for the traveling there and back and any souvenir money. So they didn't need anything else at all. Now, the quote from the travel company was a lot less than that. I can't remember exactly how much I put on, but I would probably be putting on at least £50 per child there. I did have hoodies as well, which I put into the price. So that was like another £20. So I'd say you want really at least £50 contingency. That's probably me being OTT. But I think having had this experience before where things have gone wrong.
So were you able to then give the parents some money back, actually?
Oh, yeah.
That'd be nice as a parent as well. You'd be like, oh, thanks.
Yeah, they all. I think they got about a £30, £40 refund
right,
at the end.
That's so nice.
I think, yeah, I probably, you know, if I were to run that trip again, I'd probably rethink the cost in there and think, well, maybe I didn't need quite that much. Maybe that was just me being a bit overcautious. I think you've got to be careful that, I mean, I had no problem with people paying that. It was, you know, the trip was oversubscribed. So it obviously seemed okay for parents. I could have probably gone less than that, but I'd rather just have that contingency there if I did need it. My panics this time, and this has probably taken us on to another point, was that I had this horrible fear, and again, sleepless nights, of a child with a non-British passport kind of being not allowed back into the UK or not allowed into Germany or France, I suppose it would have been. And honestly, I had sleepless nights about this because this wasn't an issue last time because of the EU. I mean, we had a couple of students who were non-EU as well, but, you know, international students. But yeah, it was, I just thought, gosh, if that's the case, we're going to have to, you know, put them up in a hotel somewhere with a member of staff. And so there was all this in the back of my mind as well. So it was just nice to know that I had that extra bit of money should something like that have happened.
Gosh, yeah. Let's talk about passports and visas, but let's just have a little look at some of the comments that we've got. Yeah. So Leanne has said, we found going by bus to near Stuttgart was excellent as we had our transport with us and had much more freedom. No hiring, airport transfers, etc., and knowledgeable bus drivers too. That is such a good point, isn't it? So actually, you know, if you're doing a city trip, so, you know, if you are going to somewhere like Berlin, then you're probably going to want to be using the public transport. But yeah, the one of the advantages, so obviously, you know, that goes back to what we're talking about, buses versus flying, is having your own coach.
Takes all the fun out of traveling on like the metro and things. I love all of that. But with 48 kids, there's no way. Would we want to take them onto the metro? No way.
No, that is true. Right. Nikki has said, my understanding is that our county insists that all schools use a company to organise trips now. We cannot do in-house trips anymore.
I think that is sensible, to be honest, if that is the decision they're making.
And Fran is saying, just to give you an estimation, now that trip would cost about £600 to £800. I've been checking different quotes and companies. Trip costs have really increased the last 2 to 3 years. But you went just for Christmas, didn't you, 2023? So it was only 4 or 5 months ago.
I went in December and we had, it was the lowest. So another thing, our school policy was that we needed 3 quotes. We didn't necessarily have to go with the cheapest quote, but I think it was just to encourage us to shop around and see what they could offer. But yeah, it was the cheapest quote. I thought it was quite reasonable, really. And again, obviously, I added quite a bit of contingency onto that. So,
yeah. What's the code? It was about four, two, five, something like that.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. The more you take, so we had a quote for 40 students and a quote for 48. I realistically thought we'd only get around the 40 mark. So, but I wanted to see what it would be if we took a few more. We did get the 48 in the end. And it brought it down even more. So, yeah, I think it might have even been slightly under 400.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the hoodie and everything as well, I think so.
And that's really fun. I mean, that's something that I feel like when I went on school trips as a kid, I would have loved that. We didn't ever do that. But yeah, I would have absolutely loved that.
Honestly, get them hoodies. It's just great. They love it. Firstly, from a safety perspective, I insisted that they wore them on the journey so that when we were on the ferry, I could spot, because they had bright red Germany hoodies, and I could spot them miles away. And actually, a lot of them wore them for the whole weekend, which is teenagers for you, isn't it? But yeah, it's great from that perspective. It's a lovely souvenir. It's great marketing for your trip as well, because a lot of them wear them on like non-uniform days, and the staff wear them on non-uniform days. And it just adds to creating that buzz, I think. So yeah, I would really recommend that. I think ours... We used a local company that about £17 each, and they could have like the, you know, our school logo on there and like her little emblem for the trip and things. It was lovely.
Oh, that's so lovely. And actually, yeah, so before we get into a bit more nitty gritty about, you know, visas and passports and stuff, which we will come on to because that is a question. Thinking about when you take a trip in terms of like, did you just say you took it over a weekend? And this is another question I've had about, so Larissa said that her school policy states you can only take students out for 3 school days, therefore implying the remaining days are over a weekend and holiday. And again, I've seen questions about this in the Facebook groups about, you know, we're having to take trips in school holidays, we have to take them over weekends. What's your experience of that, and what are your thoughts on that as well?
Oh, yeah, this is a tricky one, isn't it? So at my previous school, so previous to having children and when I ran them, you know, sort of about 8 to 9 years ago, I took them in school holidays because that was what was done at that school. And I kind of think back now and think, never in a million years am I ever going to do that again. Partly because I've got children now.
I mean, when your own children are at school, like how are you supposed to do that?
Yeah.
Saying that though, I say this like probably every other podcast episode, my mum was a languages teacher and I remember going on school trips with her, like loads of school trips with her when I was a kid. I loved it. It was great.
Yeah, that's what, yeah. I mean, a lot of my colleagues have done that before as well, and probably something that I think certainly with my daughter and her allergies, I think I'd rather have her with me than going on a school trip with her school. But anyway, that's a different story. Yeah, so we did that. That was, I don't know if it was school policy or if it was just what had been done for so long that it was kind of the expectation. we did manage to get one trip in the calendar every July, like an enrichment week. So some schools I know like have a week at the end of the year.
Yeah, like activities week or something like that. Mm.
Yeah, so we kind of kept that in the diary every year. But at my last school, we'd have sort of three, sometimes four trips going off a year. So they couldn't all go at that time. I now would look at weekends. So we did a weekend Friday to Monday. I think that's probably the most sensible option. I mean, at the end of the day, there shouldn't be any requirement to run anything in your own time, firstly. You know, if the school are sort of insisting that you do a trip, then they're going to have to provide that time for you to do it in, I say working hours. Obviously, you've got evenings as well, which you're not going to get paid for, but and nights, the nights where they're knocking on the door because they feel sick and homesick. You don't get paid for that.
But I remember a kid saying something to me about going on holiday, and I'm like, this trip is not a holiday. Like, I've barely slept for days. I'm absolutely exhausted because you lot won't go to sleep and you're running up and down the corridors and we're having to keep moving you out of each other's bedrooms and stuff in the middle of the night. I was like, this is not... Yeah, because I think they were like, oh, why do you get a free holiday? Like, I'm not paying for myself.
Yeah, I saw this on social media today where parents were kicking off about a trip to New York or something. And, oh, so basically we're paying for the teachers to go on holiday. And it's like, oh my gosh, you have, I mean, I don't even think, this is putting a lot of shade on sort of school leaders, but you know, even school leaders, if they've not been on an external visit abroad, they have absolutely no idea of the stress and the stress of being group leader. I think there is a slight difference between being a teacher, sort of accompanying on the trip. Obviously there is still responsibility with that, but the group leader side of things is something else. And you ultimately are responsible for everything, every decision that you make, you know, from beforehand while you're there. And it's a big weight to carry on your shoulders. And it's something that I definitely struggle with. I tend to find out once I get there, once I'm on the bus, I'm absolutely fine and I enjoy it. And I do worry and I do, you know, I am probably a little bit OTT with certain things, but once I'm there, I'm fine. It's the kind of organisation side of things and making sure that I've done everything that I need to do beforehand. That's where I get the most anxious. But it's a massive responsibility. And you need to think about, you know, when you want to do that. If you're prepared to do that in your holidays and you're happy with that, then go for it. But I think now I don't think that should be an expectation at all. I don't think that should happen. I think a weekend is probably a compromise there.
Mm, so, yeah, like you say, a long weekend, sort of leaving on a Thursday or Friday, coming back on a Monday. Yeah, it's a difficult one. Okay, so thinking about the actual trip then and the passports and visas and all that kind of stuff. So again, these are questions that I see all the time in the Facebook groups.
Yeah, this was my biggie this time. As I've said, I don't know why this hasn't been on my radar before. I think Brexit's definitely made a difference, but also it's just not something I'd really considered before. But I took a couple of students who had EU passports, but not British passports. And then I also had a couple of students who had international passports. And I had heard lots of horror stories, even from somebody in my own school who'd said that at his previous school, they'd gone to Spain and a child had a Spanish passport and they'd not been allowed back into the UK from Spain.
Oh my God.
So yeah, and it kind of just worried me. So on Facebook, I believe there are lots of forms and things that have been uploaded where you kind of, in the language of the country, you know, that you're going to, where you kind of get parents' permission from that side of things. I didn't take anything like that. Whether I should have done, I don't know. But what I just made sure that I had for those students with the non-British passports was evidence of either pre-settled or settled status. And it's really simple. The parent can just literally give you a code that if there was an issue, you can, or they, I don't know if it's border can check it or how it works, but there was also the card they'll photocopy for you. So I just got a photocopy of that. And as it happened, it was absolutely fine. There was no problem at all. But it just was that kind of backup, really, just in case, just trying to have as much evidence as possible. And then in terms of visas, obviously you don't need a visa for students from the EU, but any outside of the EU, it's really the parents' responsibility to check that. And we have had a student before being refused a visa. And I think simply it came down to they didn't give themselves enough time to sort it out. There was more documentation that needed to be provided. I think ultimately it was all a bit last minute and it just didn't work for them, which was a real shame. So,
but you knew all that before they came on the trip. So you had got all the information and you said, look, you haven't got the right things, and the kid wasn't allowed to come on the trip.
So in the letter I make it very, very clear that it's parents' responsibility to check the passports, to check the visa requirements. Obviously, you know, we can support with that. If a parent needs any documentation from the school, which they likely will do, they may need some other documents such as, you know, itinerary or travel insurance or something like that. But ultimately, you can't be doing that. It has to be the parent to sort that out. They're the ones that are going to need to make the appointment, the consulate, if that's what they need to do. So just make that very, very clear from the offset. Leave enough time to get that sorted. I know that's a bit passing responsibility, but
yeah,
it's too much for us to do that. It's something that the parents have to check.
And that's, you know, as you were saying about how long you leave to plan the trip. I mean, that's why, you know, 8 or 9 months is a really good amount of time, because also, if the passports aren't, I mean, I think these days you have to have TFR 6 months.
For children, it's different.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing, isn't it?
But yeah, can't remember what we said.
But either way, you know, if they need to get a new passport or something like that, you need to give them plenty of time. So actually, one of the questions that we'd had was from Nikki, who said she'd had to cancel trips recently as not enough notice was given, and they gave approximately 4 months. So you would say at least double that, so 8 or 9 months for sure. Yeah. And I could totally get that, you know, 4 months to find that kind of money for a lot of people as well. I think, you know, if you're talking £400-600, it's a lot of money for people. And
yeah, the money side of things is a difficult one, I think, because unfortunately the trip isn't going to be available to everybody because of the financial side of things. And I've really struggled with that in the past, where I've had students want to go and they've not been able to afford it. And there's certain things that the schools can do. I know there's certain funds that they can apply for that the parents can look into. And, you know, with the support of the school, I don't really get into that side of things. I sort of leave it with obviously finance to sort that out. But it's quite a difficult one, really, because you do feel, I wish there were more ways that we could, you know, make it more accessible to everybody. But unfortunately, they are what they are. That's the cost of them. And I know some parents have said, I thought this was quite an interesting take, that actually it's cheaper for them to send their child on a school trip abroad than for all of them, certainly at the moment, to go abroad on holiday.
Yeah, that's true.
So they kind of justified that, which I thought was quite an interesting take on things, when I've sort of thought, goodness me, this is a lot of money, you know, for parents to be paying. When I thought of it that way, I thought that kind of makes sense, really.
Well, it's another reason to go in term time as well, because all the flights and everything, the prices are just ridiculous in school holidays. Okay, so in terms of, yeah, more sort of, there's quite a lot of sort of questions and thoughts about quite like details, really, and things like this. So I think there's been a couple in the chat as well, but I did have a question about mobile phones. Again, this was from Nikki. Our school has a no phone policy in school and wants to do this on all school trips too. And then let me just have a little look in the chat, because I'm pretty sure that I kind of saw them popping up, and I saw a couple of things. So Claire in the chat here has just asked, do schools have to provide a mobile phone for the trip? I'm not keen on just giving my mobile number out to all the year eights. I mean, you could say, you know, what your experience. In my experience, there's a school mobile that is handed out to people who go on trips.
There is now. There wasn't when I first did them. Isn't it funny how things change over, like, I've been teaching about 17 years.
I mean, I do think the last time I took a trip, it was a brick phone. it was definitely not like, oh, here's an iPhone. It's not like, you know, my husband, like, every time whenever he starts a new job, they're like, here's an iPhone for you to use. It's not quite like that.
Oh, I know. And just having that, like, your map now to be able to guide the students. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I don't know how I did it, because my sense of direction is appalling. Even with maps on my phone, I actually got my colleague to do it, even though we went to Cologne, which is a city that I know really well, that I've spent a lot of time in and I've taken lots of trips to. I still got my colleague to go to the front, and I pretended, oh yeah, I'm just going to sort of hang around in the middle and tell everybody, you know, what they need to do. But really, I had absolutely no idea where I was going or how to use my phone. But anyway, but yeah, how I did it in the early days, I don't know. How I never got lost, I have no idea. But yeah, so for some reason, in my first couple of trips, we gave our own mobile number, which is just an absolute safeguarding and GDPR nightmare when you think about it now.
A couple of other people have said in the chat that they have a school mobile.
So now, again, they are still bricks. They're hilarious. You've still got an old little Nokia that is just a, you know, they just put some money on it, that kind of thing. So yeah, there are school mobiles. I would always take more than one. So I just think I did actually lose our trip phone this time. Luckily, it was on the way home, and I left it in the bus. So I did have it up until that point. But obviously, there is, you know, the risk that you might lose it somewhere. So yeah, trip mobile phones. In terms of a no phone policy, well, I mean...
So Nikki's actually here and has explained it in more detail. So I'm pretty sure it's the same, Nikki. So thanks for explaining that a bit more, Nikki. So she's saying the issue is that students are communicating with each other, playing etc. all day and night, and also contacting parents without staff on the trip knowing about it. So yeah, but equally, like if a kid gets lost and they don't have a phone on them these days, you know, they, like, how are they going to get in touch and, you know?
Well, this is it. I mean, you have to think about the bigger picture here and their safety. That has to be the number one. And what I would say is you are the trip leader and you are ultimately going to be responsible for those students' safety. And I know for a fact that I would not be happy students not having a mobile phone on them, whether that is that the school is able to provide 30 bricks to the students so that they can phone them, or they have, I don't know if there's like tracking devices now, but even so, I still prefer a mobile phone. Also, you know, these are cameras these days. They're not going to bring a camera. They're going to use their mobile phone. Like, I want them to take photographs for, these are memories for the rest of their lives. You know, they might never go to Germany again or France or whatever. So no, for me, absolutely, I would want them to have their mobile phones, and I make them put our school mobiles into their phones on the bus so that they've got them already. I do give them a little card as well with all the emergency contact details on, with a hotel name and everything, which they can either put in their wallet or put in the back of their phone as well. And then what I do is I send a clipboard around with all their names, and I get them to write their mobile phone numbers on a list so that if I need to contact them, and I'd obviously just make it clear that that will be destroyed as soon as we're back in school and they've all, you know, gone back home and they're all safe. So I really would recommend to do that. I mean, there, of course, there've been times where I've needed to contact a student or a student's needed to contact me, and how on earth are they going to do that if they don't have a phone? Like, what, find a payphone? I can't even get my head around that at all. I do understand the concerns. I understand the concerns of being on their phones all day, of, you know, perhaps filming their friends without consent. So I think, again, it comes down to your expectations and your communication with those students. So I would make all of this really clear in my parents' meeting before we go, so that parents are aware of my expectations of mobile phone use. And I will keep reinforcing those expectations on the trip. In terms of their own safety, no student is going to be walking around with headphones in during the daytime. They're not going to be walking around with their phone in front of their faces. I make that really, really clear. When they're walking around, they need to have all their wits about them. They need to be looking around. There's lots of cycle paths in Germany, which is fairly alien concept in England, isn't it? So all things like that. And I say to them, if you've got your head in a phone or you're listening to music, how are you going to, you know, keep yourself safe? So make that really clear. You could insist on, you know, no phones maybe at the dinner table. So we've done it before where we've actually hidden a Wi-Fi password in a hotel, so they didn't have any Wi-Fi in the hotel, which it worked brilliantly, actually, and they had to talk to each other. Do you know what, though, I find? They do want to talk to each other. They're with their friends. They're sat on it. In my experience, they don't just sit on their phones. And I think if I saw a group on their phones and not communicating, I'd probably pop over and say, you know, come on, lads, come on, girls, you know, pop those phones away, have a chat about what you've been up to today. And then at night time.
Yeah, I was just thinking overnight, I mean, can you confiscate them? Is that a bit of a safeguarding nightmare as well?
I know some people do. And again, there may be school policies on this. Your school policy may ask to take them in at night time. I didn't. I don't know whether we had a school policy on this. I probably should have checked. I did speak to a colleague who'd previously taken a trip and get her advice on this, and she didn't either. And I made those expectations clear. I said, you know, you're not to film other people without their consent. You don't take photographs of them while you're in the room. You know, you need to be comfortable with each other. And they just reminding them of things like that. And I mean, they will phone their parents. They will contact their parents. As a mum myself, I would want my daughter to contact me. I'd want to know that things are okay. Sometimes there are occasions where they've maybe phoned the parent if they've been unwell and then they've not told you. And
yeah.
But I can't think of many situations where that's happened. Usually what's happened is a student feels unwell, they've let me know. They've also phoned probably their mum just beforehand, and the mum has said, go and have a word with Mrs. Wilson. And then I've usually then phoned the mum and had a chat with her, or, you know, dad or whatever, and it's all been fine. So in my experience so far, mobile phones have been fine. It's the same as anything else you do as a teacher. You insist on those expectations, you make it clear, and you tell students of the consequences if they, you know, go against those expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, one thing that Leanne has said. So she's taken a trip where students all have their mobiles. We had to warn them to check their contract to make sure they weren't going to run up a huge bill. So that is a really, really good piece of advice for mobiles there as well.
Absolutely. We had a few years where that wasn't a problem because we were part of the EU and it was great because we got the free roaming.
I know, and it was all included. Oh, do you remember that? Oh, when it was all included. Oh, those are the days.
Now we're back to those days of expensive data.
Oh, honestly, Claire, we could talk forever. Is there anything else that we have missed? There aren't any specific questions in the chat, but there's some really, really good comments and people kind of answering each other's comments and stuff like that, which is really helpful as well. Anne has just said, rules changed, re-passports, expiry dates. Children's passports are valid for 5 years from the issue date. The expiry date occasionally shows 5 years plus a few extra months when the previous passport got renewed before its expiry date. Never take the expiry date into consideration. Only look at the valid from date plus 5 years. Yes. And I think so for adults' passports, it's 10 years. So yes, it has to be 5 years or 10 years from when it was issued. That's the new rules. Okay. Yeah. So is there anything else? Anything else that we've missed that we've not?
Well, one thing I would say, if this is your first ever trip or if this is a trip that you are maybe taking at a new school, I really would recommend going and chatting to somebody who has run a trip before, whether that's a colleague in your department. That wasn't the case at my school, but I went to go and see some of the humanities department who'd taken trips previously that year. Very experienced members of staff, and it was so useful. And they sent me loads of stuff. They sent me loads of risk assessments. They told me ways they did things. So, for example, something that was different from what I'd always done was with passports, actually. Previously, I had taken photocopies of passports. So this is something to say, and also remind parents for GHIC cards.
Yeah.
So although you've got the travel insurance, it makes life so much easier if they've got the GHIC, so the old EHIC or E111 as it used to be years and years ago.
Oh, wow.
I know, sorry, I'm going very far back there.
Showing your age there, Claire.
I don't know if I'm that old. I'm sure probably as a child I had an E111.
Yeah.
But yeah, so take photocopies of those. But what I did before, I did not want the responsibility of passports. So I used to say to students that they would hand me them as they got on the bus or as we got to the airport. And then I would take them in and then I would give them to the staff groups. So I always have smaller groups with a member of staff. So just when you go through museums and things like that, then it's kind of like remote supervision, but you've got a member of staff sort of nearby. So that's kind of a different conversation that we could have really there. But yeah, so you've got the staff groups and they carry the passports. However, at my current school, I don't know if it was policy or just the general thing, was that you actually took the passports in and kept them in school before we left. So you'd got all of the passports, you knew you had them all. And we kept them locked away in the finance office. And my concern was I had to then bring 48 passports home and make sure I got them all one day. And that terrified me. However, this might be the thing now is obviously with flights and checking in, you may need to check in beforehand. And also for us, we went with P&O ferries. I had to scan the passports 24 hours before. It's a new thing that they do.
Oh, interesting.
So it's just worth thinking about that in terms of passports. As I say, I used to just wait until we got there and then got passports handed in. You need to think about whether you need them, you know, for sort of checking in reasons, admin reasons, stuff like that.
And I'm assuming that the days of collective passports or group passports, whatever, they don't exist anymore, do they? Again, this is going back to like, I remember when I was a kid and my mum used to run trips. I swear that they had this like one document that was like the group passport for everyone. And also, but I do remember just being kind of waved through on a bus. They'd be like, oh, whatever.
Honestly, it was absolutely fine. It was very, very, very simple. But I have heard a few stories it hasn't been.
During the trip, would you keep the passports in a safe in the hotel?
No. So we kept them with us.
Okay.
I mean, I've got that thing, you know, in Europe, you generally need to carry ID with you anyway. Yeah. So what I did is I got them all home. I split them all into the staff groups. So we had staff groups of about 8 to 10 students. And I put them all in a zip wallet. And in that zip wallet, I also had like copies of the risk assessments, attendance registers for staff, so overall attendance register and ones for their little group as well. So I created a pack for each member of staff and they had the passports there as well. We did take them round with us. And I also had photocopies in a folder.
Okay. We have just had a comment from someone else saying they kept them in the safe in the hotel in Spain. They didn't carry them with them. So
ideally you would want to, wouldn't you? Ideally you would want to. I think it was just that, I don't know. I just have this, it's just a thing where I think we need the ID, but maybe children don't. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I don't know. Again, I think I think your advice of talking to somebody in your school, I was just thinking if you're in a trust, you know, multi-academy trust, perhaps if there's somebody in another school in the trust who has run a trip recently, using the Facebook groups, you know, contact us, ask us questions. I'm sure we can point you in the right direction for things as well. You know, there's, but I think my biggest takeaway is there are so many little details and you don't want to miss out. You know, you don't want to miss something that could be essential. So, you know, if you've got a question about anything, you need to ask people that question. Don't just think, oh, whatever, you know, it'll be fine. Like, I think if it's something that's in the back of your mind that's a question, then do ask. We have had one more question, actually. So before we wrap up, what's your advice about spending money?
Oof. You know, I'd not thought about this until I got asked this question at the parents' meeting. I think you just need to remind students, firstly, that it is their responsibility. So be sensible with how much they take.
And would you recommend that they take cash in euros?
Yeah, so I usually recommend a mixture of cash in euros and pound sterling. As I say, you know, for food on the way down, if we stop at a service station, and also, you know, for souvenirs and what have you out there. A lot this time, and again, this is where things have changed so much since I last went, some had like prepaid debit cards as well.
Yeah, like a Revenue, you know, card or something like that. That could work quite well. Yeah.
I'm going to be honest, I'm not 100% about any of that. I don't know how they work or anything, but I know some parents had looked into that. So I left that kind of up to parents, really. I think it just depends. Tell them to be sensible. Tell them that it's their responsibility. Mixture of both. I think I said about £50 is probably enough. I'm sure
lots took much more than that.
I think, you know, they're wanting McDonald's. They probably don't want a lot less than that, because if they're wanting ice creams and bratwurst at the Christmas market. And just to remind them as well about safety at things like, if you're going to Christmas markets, if you're going to Disneyland, safety of money, you know, tell them where to keep it, how to keep it safely.
Yeah, I remember being pickpocketed in Cologne when I was a kid. Very annoying.
Yeah. Another thing I've just thought of that I just do want to say as well is on medication. What I do with medication, obviously, again, you'll have had all the medical forms come in. I do ask parents to provide spare medication, which I carry. So it just made me think when we were talking about the passports. Again, I don't know if other staff do this, but I like to have that spare medication with me just in case, you know, an inhaler's lost or even more, because you don't want to be at the pharmacy in the middle of the night trying to sort out medication. So.
Okay, I keep saying this is the last question. There's one more. But I have a very quick answer to this. What do you do if a student forgets to buy an adapter plug from Melanie? I mean, my answer is they can borrow one from someone else, or they can, if they've got spending money, they can buy one, or their phone battery goes dead. I don't know. I mean, yeah.
So I think sometimes there are USB chargers sometimes. True, as well. Yeah. I don't know. It depends on the room. You can't guarantee that's going to be the case. But again, you do need to keep reminding them to charge their batteries, or the amount of batteries that we, you know, kids, miss, my battery's dead, and we're trying to kind of get them charged last minute. And this is why it's so important that they've got their mobile phones and that they're in groups of four, so that there's always somebody in that group.
I was going to say, yeah, that they're never, ever, ever on their own. That is another absolutely essential piece of advice, isn't it? Yeah.
No. And this is the panics that you get from parents at parents' meeting. Will they be on their own? Absolutely not. They will never be on their own. And if they are on their own, I'm going to be having some serious words, because it will be made very clear. It's very short times, usually an hour maximum, where they will be in small groups with a little bit of roaming around time, with very strict boundaries, with a staffed checkpoint, meeting point. So even if you send them back off, you know, keep those regular check-ins with them at least every hour, just to make sure everything's okay.
Oh, I'm sure there are so many more questions and so many things we could talk about, but that was so helpful. That was absolutely brilliant. Okay, Claire, where can people find you? So if you are happy to answer some more questions once people have heard this episode when it comes out, and just so they can witness your fabulousness in general, where can people find you?
Of course, you can ask me questions. I mean, I'm sure I have made this clear, but you know, this is my experience. I'm sure I've missed lots of things out. I hope I haven't given misinformation, but please just don't take what I've said as gospel. Please do check with your own school, your own policies, your own EVC, just to make sure, you know, how things go. But this is just me just kind of getting my thoughts out of my experience over the last few years. But yes, if you'd like to contact me, please do. Please ask me any questions. I think Instagram's probably the best. Yeah. So you can find me at _Leo Languages on Instagram.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Yeah.
You can find me on LinkedIn now, Claire Wilson. I don't check that quite as much, but I will sporadically check that. I've just started a Facebook page as well, so you can find me on Facebook. That's probably the best way, really. But I think Instagram. If you have Instagram, message me on there, because I'm on there like every 20 seconds.
Yeah. I shouldn't be, but I am. Yep, same, same. I think that's where we've, well, no, obviously, I mean, so to go back about 5 years or even maybe even longer, you did some French with me, didn't you?
I did.
Yes, but I feel like we've connected the most on Instagram since then as well.
Yes. So.
And also just randomly appearing on my podcast regularly. So thank you so, so, so much. And thank you for all the comments and the questions and things like that from everybody as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, there is so much to cover. As I say, I mean, I have got pages of notes, and I think probably what I do need to do is a kind of like cheat guide to running a school trip, really, and maybe kind of provide that.
Oh, that'd be, I reckon, yeah, yeah, people would love that. It'd be really useful.
Probably make it fewer than about 10 pages, which I've got now. But there is so much, and every school context is very different. Obviously, there's other types of trips as well that we've not even had chance to speak about. So there's a lot to think about.
I know, we didn't even get a chance to talk about exchanges, sorry. So what we've been talking about is mainly these sort of, you know, activities, trips where you're staying in hotels and things like that.
Yeah.
So sorry, we didn't even get
to... Yeah, I have less experience of exchanges. I have taken an exchange, but it was a colleague had organised it. I just went in her place because she was on maternity leave. So I don't really have a lot of experience with exchanges, unfortunately.
Maybe that'll be one for another time. I'll get someone else who's done more exchanges.
I think that'd be really good.
Okay, well, like I say, thanks so much, Claire. And
you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Kate Languages podcast. If you did, please think about leaving me a 5-star review. And you can also tag me on social media to let me know you've been listening and let me know your thoughts on the episode. Also, don't forget to subscribe so the next episode of the Kate Languages podcast can be delivered straight to your device as soon as it's released. But until then, auf Wiedersehen, au revoir, adios, bye.